Welcome once again to the chat room. Nice to have your company. The fastest 28 minutes on television. We're going to go through a whole lot of stuff really quickly in the next 28 minutes, packing it in.
Does that mean I have to speak faster?
Well, as fast as you possibly can, because what we're going to talk about is how we understand the past. And how do you understand the past? From television miniseries, movies, or do you read the big thick books? Well, I think it's the movies. Don't you think most people get their ideas of the past from
Yes. And the big, thick books are a bit too big and thick these days, I've noticed. A couple of the ones I've read of recent times, they tell me what the man had at breakfast on the 3rd of June. You know,
all that detail.
And they're terrified, I think, of not giving all the detail because the reviews will be critical. Whereas you need the storyline.
And they seem not to have the judgment to actually know what matters, so I'll just stick it all in.
We put everything in there. Yes, that's right. And so I read one on Bertrand Russell, two volumes. Well, at the end of the first volume, he was still only 45. I mean, there was a long way yet to go.
But most of us are going to get it through the media. The media tells us what the past was like, doesn't it?
It's also more powerful. That is, as I read a book, my imagination can be engaged and I can imagine people look like this or did that. But once you see it in a film, it fills in all the background for me and says, this is what he actually looked like. And it's very hard for me then not to think he looked like that.
And this is how people had meals and this is et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
This is how they travel.
He will have worn this wig this way. And these are the kinds of wigs which I, in my imagination, wasn't thinking about the wigs that they did or didn't wear.
But when we do that, we're handing over the way we understand the past to the people who make those programs, aren't we?
Yes, but we do that when we read a book.
Oh, yes, yeah, okay.
To some extent, but to a lesser extent. And with a book, I can stop and think. With a film, it just keeps coming all the time. I don't have the chance to stop and think back about that. The DVD, we can replay them. People can now replay this conversation. We can just do it ourselves. Now we can do a little repeat for them. But with the films, generally, I'm just watching. And because I'm watching the central point, I'm actually not paying attention to the feel, the ambience that they've created, that this was the 17th century, that it actually looked like this, or people spoke like this.
I saw a quite good film biography of Luther, with Ralph Fiennes or someone as Luther. It's a good cast. But it all goes past so quickly, you don't have time to say, what would it have been like that? No. Would the attitude have been like that?
Hang on. Couldn't have been this. And it's the attitudes on little things. I mean, Hollywood makes every hero a Democrat, you know, as opposed to a Republican.
A Democrat as opposed to an autocrat.
Yes. And democracy and high humanistic ideals.
And every heroine is a feminist. 14th century or not, she's a feminist.
Yes, that's right. And so all that's just carted back into that whatever century it might be.
So how do we really understand history? What are the tools we need if we're actually going to understand how our forebears functioned?
There are facts, and facts in some ways are recorded. And so you can check your views, your world view, by the information that is recorded in original documents. The problem is, life is too short to do that with every issue and every film I've ever seen.
Yes.
And so I can theoretically do it, but I rarely ever have a chance to do it. You hope professional historians are doing it, but professional historians have their worldview. And it's very hard for them to see what actually was there in the original.
And one of the things it seems to me, tell me if I'm wrong on this, seems to me that myths develop about bits of history, which then are just accepted because they're myths and they're passed on and on and on and on, and it was actually like this. If you went back and researched it, it wasn't like that, but we now widely believe it. It's just become accepted.
That's the joy of the historian, that he can challenge all his fellow historians with a new view by looking at the facts. But on the other hand, he has to himself be free from the mythology to look at the facts the right way.
Secularists think they can be, don't they?
Oh, yes. There's this belief in objectivity and neutrality that they think they have.
Right.
When, in fact, it's inevitable that we'll be biased, that can't be avoided. What's really important is understanding our bias and making allowance for our bias.
Right.
Because I want them to believe X, Y, Z, I really, therefore, should be looking for evidence against X, Y, Z.
Right. Hard to do that, though.
Oh, yes, because I always want to confirm my prejudices rather than debunk my prejudices. And But if I live in a culture like the historians and the media in that culture where everybody shares the same prejudices, I don't think they're actually prejudices.
Yes, I'm not aware of them in the same way a fish is not aware it's wet. I'm just in that environment all time.
That's right. It's the worst of all conspiracies. I'm not a great conspiracy theorist. Conspiracies always give me creeps, especially about people who believe everything's a conspiracy. They are worrying people. But the worst kind of conspiracy is the unconscious conspiracy.
Right.
I don't even know I'm in it.
I'm just repeating what I've heard, and we all think that that's got to be right.
So if everybody in your press room has the same kind of basic view about a subject, and your family has that basic view, and your lecturers at university have that basic view, you don't realise that you're in a conspiracy, because it's not actually a conscious conspiracy. There's not some mastermind behind it controlling it. It's just... That's the way the world is viewed.
The Germans have got a word for it, because the Germans have got a word for everything, which is the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. And we could be the prisoners of the moment in which we live, the captives of it.
Which is one of the great reasons for studying history.
Yes.
To free yourself from it.
There've got to be objective, knowable facts. I mean, an example that occurs to me is a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Kirsten Burkett, who looked at the business of Christians persecuted Galileo.
Yes.
And they happen to be Christians, but they persecuted him because they're Aristotelians.
Yes.
And he was contradicting Aristotle, not the Bible. And that's what they were upset about.
And it wasn't the church, it was the academy.
Yes, yes. So when she actually looked, there were real objective facts there to be found.
Yes, you can find them and you can debunk. But you've got to be inside the club for your debunking to be accepted.
Yes.
And if you are inside the club, you're unlikely to look at them to debunk it, because it's just what you basically assume. And that's a real problem for people, because history is cross-cultural study. That's the beauty of it, because it frees us from being imprisoned in our own culture. But that's the difficulty of it. I've got to step outside of my own culture, back into this person's culture who lived in another time. And it can only be 40 years ago, but it's a different culture.
Yes.
You know, and then think how they thought, which will involve me understanding how they lived, which involves little things like whether they put flowers in pots or whether they had glass or whether they... I mean, it's the whole range of things.
What they would have thought was absolutely inconceivable, unacceptable, is normal to us.
Yes. And the language they used, the words, the choice of words they used, and the meanings they had to those words will affect and express how they think. But of course, when we write history, not only do I have to put myself into the cross-cultural experience, but then to write it, I've got to write it for my own culture. So in the process of it, I've got to translate to my culture, which requires me to sufficiently understand my own culture to be able to do the translation from one to the other.
Let's talk about that breaking down, because people who are in the club, people who are in this culture, then report the past without doing that sort of step.
Yeah.
And a kind of... I mean, am I being unkind if I say there's an anti-Christian bias that creeps in?
At the moment, in the last 50 years, I think there's a profound and complete anti-Christian bias, both in history and in media reportings.
Okay, so in history, how does it show itself?
The Christian understanding of many of the great actors of life is either omitted completely or ridiculed. It's often misunderstood, and the Christianity is misexpressed. Often the ex-Roman Catholic secularist historian will assume that the Christianity of a person was Roman Catholicism.
Right.
And they just write it up as if it's Roman Catholic, when in fact the person will be very different. Or there's stereotypes. As Calvinists are always seen as a particular...
Cold-hearted,
and it's all about predestination, and it's all about fatalism. Well, Calvinist is not fatalist, but they're always presented that way.
And Calvin himself talked about the doctrines of grace, which is the opposite of cold and hard.
Yes, but that can't fit into the stereotypical view we have of Calvinists. So, but there's also just the general religious acceptance in the society. People went to war for God, king and empire. Well, I don't know what they meant when they went to war for God, but they meant it because all their obelisks say it. So what were they thinking? What did God have to do with
If I signed up for the First World War and I was fighting for God, king and empire, It was part of why I was there.
That's not part that is explored in people's writing back at that period of time. It assumes that they were as godless as our generation is. And so there's a whole range of ways. Part of the problem is, why do we tell the story? There are people who are just interested in stories for story's sake, who just want to know what happened in the past.
Right.
But for many people, the telling of the story is a way of teaching my worldview to my contemporaries. And so really I'm just bringing out from the past the illustrations that will make sense of the world I live in now.
So I tell the story of the past to say this is what it means, therefore this is what our life means.
Yes, and this is why we have come to a better understanding. So as soon as they mention the 50s, sexually repressed, white picket fence, most of the people weren't there. Now sometimes it's purposeful, it's intentional. There is a particular agenda being driven, and sometimes the use of the 50s and 60s is agenda driven. But you take the film Inherit the Wind, which was the film about the Scopes monkey trials back in the 20s. It actually was wrong. The details were inaccurate. One of the quotes taken from one character was put in the mouth of a different character. And so the hero was sanitised.
Yes.
By the filmmakers. And the villain was demonised.
And they sanitised
him. Intentionally.
Just by casting Spencer Tracy in the role. Immediately he becomes a hero.
Yes, you portray who the good guys are and the bad guys by... I mean, I saw a photograph of one of our political leaders today, and as soon as I saw it, it's in the newspaper, as soon as I saw it, I thought, the journalist, the editor and the photographer hate that man. They don't want him elected.
Chose that photo deliberately.
Because of all the thousands of expressions that will happen on a person's face in a day, they picked the one that is unpleasant, that fits the stereotype of what they want to say.
Yes.
Now, that's crude and crass, but in a movie, yes, you pick the right actor.
And you disguise the fact...
the dog The other actor, you know, wears the black hat, and you give it 100 different ways. Well, that one... But that one was just historically disastrous. So in the late 20th century, there was a book written by a man called Larson called A Summer for the Gods, not written from a Christian perspective, which tediously went through what happened with the Scopes trials.
In reality.
In reality. And so debunks the Inherit the Wind movie. But who reads a book that tediously goes through what everybody does in the Scopes trials, and who pulls down the video or the DVD and watches Inherit the Wind? I mean, that's the world knows the Scopes trials through Inherit the Wind. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not thinking that I would defend what was done or not. I mean, the law. I'm not only anything with the right, the wrong of the monkey trials, but. You know, the teacher is portrayed as a man who is just going about his business, teaching science, and the local redneck fundamentalist grabbed hold of him and put him in. It wasn't like that at all. He was set there by an atheistic group to provoke the case. He intended to provoke the case.
They advertised for someone who would provoke the case for them, please.
Yes. But that's not how it's... portrayed.
Yes.
And the hero who argues the case walks away with the Bible in one hand and Darwin in the other hand. But he was an out-and-out atheist who was very anti-Christian.
Yes.
But that's not portrayed.
Yes.
Now, it's sometimes historical agenda driving, because atheists are particularly offended by anyone who believes in creation, and therefore really offended by anyone who believes in creationism.
Right.
Of which that represents. I mean, this is red rag to them, and they obviously put the show on. Likewise, you can see that marvellous film, Gandhi, which is a wonderful film, but had absolutely nothing to do with historical accuracy, funded by a particular government to put a particular spin on the story of Gandhi, anti-British spin. Now, what Britain did in India and Pakistan, I don't particularly want to defend. But if this is history, this is what's not. It's a political agenda that's being driven.
If this sort of thing is going on, it seems to me important that we are not deceived, that somehow we are undeceived. We don't believe the myths. We don't just swallow gullibly whatever is fed to us, that somehow or other we see through to the truth. Is it important?
It's important, but very, very difficult.
Is it worth making the effort?
It's worth making the effort on big issues for everybody. Right. It's worth the community making the effort as a community on every issue. But I can't do every issue.
No, no.
You see, I want to see whether Samuel Marsden has been misrepresented.
The second missionary pastor to come to Australia vilified is probably the right word in the history books as the flogging parson, because part of what he did was to be a magistrate in fairly hard times.
Dreadfully hard times, and only for a period of time that he was there. From my perspective, I'd say that was a mistake to have done that. I would never become a magistrate. However, I'm here now.
Yes.
If I was there in a penal colony, it wasn't like a prison where everyone was behind bars. They lived with the convicts.
And he was anxious about the level of morality in society in general.
Yeah. Now, did he flog people more than any other magistrate at the time? Was it a particular penchant he had for hurting people, etc.? You can only find that out by spending days and days in a library counting up statistics of whatever records are there. Some Christian needs to go and do it.
Right, tell the story properly.
And yes, go and find out.
Because the rest of his story is a good story, isn't it? A
terrific story. He was the man who brought Christianity to New Zealand. He was the first white man to make friends with the Maoris. He really tried to help the Aborigines here in Sydney. He started orphanages. He started schools. He was one of the founders of education in New South Wales. He planted churches. His life was full of good works for other people.
We need the movie. We need the movie that really
tells
the story.
Samuel Marsden's life was well worthy of a movie.
Yes.
Had an invalided wife for most of his adult life. I mean, he was a man of enormous energy and who's one of the most important people in colonial Australia. But he's just remembered for this one thing.
Yes.
Now, in the process, he made a lot of enemies. You see, he was against the rum traders of the New South Wales court. And they were the powerful people who ran the colony. So they hated Samuel Marsden. John MacArthur, and he contended in some ways as the father of the sheep industry. The first commercial fleece sent to England was not MacArthur, it was
Marsden. Yes.
So he has many ways. He's the father of our pastoral industries.
But he had enemies, as
he
result.
Had enemies. And so they have capitalised on retelling this story.
But the very first William Charles Wentworth had a personal feud with Marsden, and therefore his contemporary records of Marsden are biased because he didn't like him.
Yes. Now, don't get me wrong, there have been some good historians. Mr. Yarwood wrote a very interesting history of Marsden, putting some of the facts correct. And I think as Yarwood's one goes on, you see him liking Marsden more and more. He gives an interesting analysis of his Yorkshire background and why he would be the kind of man that he was. But I still would like someone to go and actually check.
Yes.
And it may be at the end he was a flawed character in this area.
Right. But it may well be he was not. He was just actually behaving like every other magistrate at the time. You'd have to do the comparative study, wouldn't you?
And even if you did, at the end of it, you could say, this man did 1,000 things good and a very bad thing.
Right.
But what we're told is, this man did one bad thing.
Yes.
That's all he's remembered for in Australia.
And that wipes him out. We don't need to consider the rest.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, he actually did many, many wonderful things. And every character of history other than the Lord Jesus Christ has got flaws.
Yes.
Big flaws.
Even our great heroes, yes.
Yes. Yes. So it's not surprising if he did do a bad thing.
But let me mention, by the way, if you're interested, the books by A.T. Yarwood, there's a long book, big thick book, called Marsden the Survivor, and a shorter, quicker book to read called Marsden of Parramatta. I don't know if they're in print, but check a library. It might be worth looking at, because it is a great story.
I've only read the big thick one. I didn't realise there's a short one. You should have told me.
I'm the journalist. I read the short one. We do the quick research. We know about these things.
You know properly then, don't you?
But someone should turn it into a movie. But sometimes Christian stories are turned into movies.
Yes.
I mean, take the case of William Wilberforce and Amazing Grace.
Yes.
I loved the movie.
A great movie.
Was I being misled, or was it more or less accurate, do you think?
It was a great movie because he was a great man who did many wonderful things. A movie gets caught between the fact that it has to reconstruct totality So everything is there: the house, the clothes, the kind of grass, the kinds of vehicles. Everything has to be reconstructed. While at the same time, it's trying to tell a story which requires selection. It requires just picking the core element to. A good storyteller doesn't tell you everything.
And there has to be conflict. So you have to amplify the conflict. That's what you've got to bring out. Without conflict, there isn't a story to tell on the screen.
That's right. So the Wilberforce you got was a small section of Mr. Wilberforce. He had a whole range of issues he fought for. Slavery was one of them.
Right.
Oh, anti-slavery was one of them. The other ones don't even get a mention. He was very important in bringing Christianity out here to the Australian colony. And he was in correspondence with Samuel Marsden about what was happening in the New South Wales colony.
And a founder of the Church Missionary Society and a founder of the Bible Society and stuff like that.
And so that's one area. It's what's not in the novel. Well, in the movie, you can't blame them. They've got 2 hours. But then what was there was a distorted view. It was clear he was Christian, but his Christianity was never explained. His conversion was lying in the grass.
Emotional happened to him, because if you're not a Christian, then you think it must be something emotional you don't understand.
Well, in fact, he went on a walking tour through Europe and studied the Bible with an old teacher friend of his and became convinced, and then turned back to England to evangelise England and his peers in particular, and was concerned about the moral standards of England, of which anti-slavery was one element. But his concern was the teaching of God's word, and that's what he was concerned about.
Yeah, that doesn't come across. John Newton is not well represented.
Well, John Newton, I again have to check, because I don't know. But the presentation of John Newton was a wonderful character by a very fine actor. But it has never crossed my mind in my wildest figments of imagination that John Newton was anything like that. Now, he may have been, and my imagination might be completely wrong, but he came across as a medieval Catholic monk doing penance by mopping down the floor in goat's hair, when in fact he was a thoroughgoing evangelical, a great letter writer and encourager of people all around the world, who was a city Bible teacher.
He was a compulsive, incessant preacher. It's what he spent most of his life doing, was preaching. And we didn't catch a glimpse of him doing that.
No, I just don't get that it was...
Yes.
Now, on the other hand, it was much better than most, because at least they left Christianity in.
Yes.
Often they take it out. So there's a story of the Lions of Savo in Kenya that was made into a film in the late 20th century about a man called John Patterson. Well, he's turned into a humanist atheist who's beyond conversion. Well, in fact, he was a keen Bible-believing Christian.
Right. So that's a massive distortion.
Yes, and then they brought in an American character who didn't exist. Because that's important to get the American market to buy, because if there's no American there, then no heroic act could have happened.
Yes. We would have lost the First World War, the Second World War, everything, unless they came in at the last.
And so the whole history is just totally distorted for media. And here is a keen Christian man whose Christianity is wiped out of what made him do what he did to help in the fighting against these wild lions. Also, the morality is left out. That is, the reason why the lions went feral and started eating humans was because of the local practice of euthanasia, where they left bodies out in the jungle. And
to encourage the lions.
And the lions got the taste of human flesh and started turning to eat more humans. And the whole, that's too politically incorrect to mention, let alone to film what actually went wrong. But there's the kinds of, you just remove Christianity from the story.
Now, getting towards a bottom line, a lesson for us, we need to be cautious as Christians about just accepting what we see and hear, don't we?
Yes. And we need to check, especially when it deals with the heart of our Christian faith, about the Bible.
Right.
When they write, when they show you about the Bible. See, when my children went to high school, they were given, two of them went to two different schools, they were given the same Year 7 ancient history textbook. And it was about the ancient Near East, Egypt, Palestine, Greece. I immediately got hold of it and looked it up, and there was one reference to Jesus. So I opened it up, and it was about page 5, in which it said, "The reason historians divide the world as BC and AD is because in previous generations, people thought the most important thing that happened in the ancient world was Jesus Christ." Now, that's a good illustration of the censorious attitude of modern historians.
We're really modern. We're over that now.
We're over that.
Yes.
And so now we do a thing called BCE and CE, you know, before Common Era and the Common Era. Well, there never has been a Common Era. That's a complete myth.
It's an invention.
Yes. I mean, the Chinese date the world differently. The Muslims date it differently. The Jews date it differently.
The Hindus date it differently.
The only people who have dated it where we date it are Christians. Yes. And they're dating it before Christ and in the year of the Lord because they think that Christ was the most important part of the ancient history. That which other generations said was the most important thing in ancient history, our moderns think is worth one note just to explain why we've got this weird dating system.
Right, right.
Now, that's not a matter of teaching children about facts. That's teaching people a view of the ancient world.
Now, we can't change everything. I mean, as Christians in our society, we're in the minority as it happens.
Yeah.
Other people are going to publish the textbooks. Other people are going to make the movies. We can't change everything. So we just need to know that we've got to stand back a bit and be cautious.
Yes. We also need to encourage Christian historians to write history that is Christian, that will write a Christian worldview about what happened.
So history wouldn't in fact be a bad profession for a Christian to go into.
No, it's a wonderful profession because through it you explain your worldview to your contemporaries.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Christians can do it because our worldview is based on the facts and the truth. And so you can write a Christian history.
So there you are. Consider history is a profession. Be careful about what it is you believe. And if you've got a spare $10 million, send it to us. We'll make the movie about Samuel Marsden.